The San Francisco Bay Area Committee to Save the Rosenbergs presents They Must Not Die, the documented story of the Rosenbergs, written by Fiz Mezzi and produced by the San Francisco Labor Theater. July 1950, Monroe Street, Knickerbocker Village. A housing project on New York's Lower East Side. An ordinary apartment, $45 a month, including utilities. The usual second-hand furniture, new-looking console table from Macy's, a box full of children's toys. This is the Rosenberg home. Julius is 34, a mild-tempered man raised on New York's Lower East Side. He is a graduate in engineering from New York City College, worked as an engineer for the government for a few years, and like millions of other Americans, he belongs to a union, the Federation of Architects, Engineers, Chemists, and Technicians. Now he runs a small machine shop near his home and barely makes a living for his family. Ethel, his wife, is a small woman with dark eyes and a sweet smile. She'd gone to the same high school as Julius, but went to work after graduation. At various times, she studied voice, Hebrew, and stenography. Then she stayed home with her two boys, Mike, who is 8, and Robbie, 3. Yesterday, there was the sound of laughter.
What does a cow go? And how does a duck go?
Quack. Quack, 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 quack.
Hey, look, Robbie, look. This is how a duck walks. Come on, Mommy. You walk like a duck.
Walk like a duck, Mommy.
No more now, Robbie. Come on, boys. Put the chairs back and play quietly until Daddy comes home.
Oh, Mommy, sing us a song from the new book Daddy brought.
Oh, all right. What shall I sing?
Aunt Rhody. Aunt Rhody. Aunt Rhody.
Well, then help me sing, darling.
Go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody, oh, great
little sister. Hey, it's Daddy.
Daddy, Daddy. Hi, Daddy. Hi.
Hi, Daddy.
Julie. You look... Julie, is something wrong?
Hey, boys, look what I brought. Take it into the kitchen and open it up.
Oh, boy. Come on, Robbie.
Now, you let your brother open it up with you, Mike. Julie, can I get you something?
No. No, Ethel, sit down. Please.
I'm sitting.
Have you seen the papers?
No. But every time you look like that,
this is another about David.
Oh. Well, what is it?
The FBI picked him up yesterday.
But why?
He confessed to stealing some secrets when he was at Los Alamos.
Oh, no.
He confessed, Ethel. He said he memorized some drawings and made a detailed report. He said he got $500 for it.
Impossible. Why, he's never been able to memorize anything. He flunked every technical course he ever took. There must be some mistake.
That's what I thought.
But I can't believe he'd get involved.
I can, Ethel. He was scared, and when a man's scared, he... I didn't tell you, but he came to the shop about a month ago. Told me he was in some kind of trouble. Needed $2,000 right away. Ethel, where was I going to raise $2,000? I told him I only owed him $1,000, and I couldn't even raise that. He got sore, lost his head, and hit me. And then he said something peculiar. He said, well, Julie, I've just got to have that money, and if you don't get me that money, you're going to be sorry.
Why didn't you tell me about that?
Because you would have worried yourself sick. Every time your baby brother gets himself in hot water, you or your mother bail him out. It's always poor Davy, little Davy. Ethel, when are you going to learn that he's weak and dependent, that he's been using you for a crutch all his life? And Ruthie eggs him on. Ethel, where are you going?
To help Davy.
Ethel, sit down.
I'm going.
Not this time. Don't get yourself mixed up in it. I'll go.
Yes? Julius Rosenberg?
Hey, wait a minute. Don't push in here. Who are you?
Federal Bureau of Investigation. They want you at headquarters to answer some questions about your brother-in-law, David Greenglass.
I have nothing to say.
Julie, please, what are you saying?
Ethel, keep out of this.
Julie, I beg you, go with them. Davy's in trouble.
Yes, Davy was in trouble. Serious trouble. The grand jury in New Mexico had just indicted him for stealing information on atomic experiments when he was stationed at the Los Alamos Project in 1945. But that July afternoon in 1950, Julius learned that the FBI was no longer primarily interested in David Greenglass, but rather in him. Greenglass had implicated him in the espionage plot. Julius was arrested. A month later, Ethel Rosenberg was called to testify before a grand jury. Leaving the courtroom, she was arrested and hustled off to the women's detention home, indicted with her husband for conspiracy to commit espionage. But the press went far beyond the indictment. All during the 14 months leading up to the trial, the press fed the public spy stories, charging the Rosenbergs with crimes never even mentioned in the indictment. Remember the headlines in 1950?
Troops mobilized to avert riot over Robeson.
University of California passes loyalty oath.
U.S. sends troops to Korea.
11 top communists convicted.
And then...
Commie spies indicted!
Red spies to tell all!
Yes. The arrest of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg was a fitting climax. Now all that was needed to keep the hysteria in pitch was a trial. An absolute conviction. A great big neon finger pointing out an act of treason by two individuals of progressive leanings. April 1951. The courtroom was tense, hushed. Government prosecutor Irving Sapol stepped forward.
May it please your honor, Mr. Foreman and ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the evidence will show that the loyalty and the allegiance of the Rosenbergs was not to our country, but that it was to communism. Communism in this country and communism throughout the world.
Defense attorney Emanuel Block rose in protest.
If the court pleases, I ask the court to instruct the district attorney to desist from making any remarks about communism, because communism is not on trial here.
Again and again, the prosecution hammered at the implication that Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were communists. At one point, even Judge Irving Kaufman interrupted to address the jury.
I want you to understand right at the outset that the fact that the defendants were members of the Communist Party...
The defense attorney rose to his feet.
Your Honor, there has been no evidence up to this point that the Rosenbergs were communists, and I object to the introduction of this subject as irrelevant, misleading, and inflammatory.
The trial proceeded. The prosecution had announced that 118 witnesses would be called, among them top atomic scientists. But only 20 witnesses took the stand. And it was only two witnesses, David and Ruth Greenglass, who even attempted to link the Rosenbergs to an atomic espionage plot. Listen now to some of David Greenglass's testimony under cross-examination by defense attorney Block.
In 1945, I gave Julius Rosenberg a sketch of a lens mold. I marked the parts of the mold A, B, and C, and I defined what the markings meant.
Would you examine Government's Exhibit 2 for identification and tell me if this is the sketch which you prepared?
Yeah, that's the sketch that I prepared.
When did you prepare this?
During the trial yesterday.
When did you last see the original sketch, which you turned over to Rosenberg?
In January 1945.
And you have not seen it since?
No.
Now, Mr. Greenglass, can you sketch every lens mold upon which you worked while at the shop in Los Alamos?
Not every one, but I can draw or sketch a good deal of them.
A good deal of them? Showing the developing process and the improvements that have been made. Can you do that?
Well, the sketches are... I mean, it'd be very difficult to tell which one was the improvement over the other.
You did not even know the formulas, did you?
No.
You had to be a scientist to know the formula, isn't that right?
Yes.
But you are a machinist.
That is correct.
Did you ever get a degree in science?
I did not get a degree.
Did you ever get a Bachelor of Science degree?
I did not.
Did you ever get an engineering degree from a recognized institution?
I did not.
Did you ever take courses in calculus?
No.
Differential calculus?
I did not.
Or thermodynamics?
I did not.
Or nuclear physics?
I did not.
Or atomic physics?
I did not.
Or quantum mechanics?
I did not.
Or advanced calculus?
I did not.
No more questions.
This is the record. This is the testimony of the man who claimed he drew from memory an elaborate sketch of the atom bomb together with 12 pages of descriptive material. This is the star witness for the prosecution. But where were the scientists to back him up? The prosecution had promised that Drs. J. Robert Oppenheimer and Harold C. Urey, heads of the atom bomb project, would testify. Why weren't they called? Was the prosecution afraid of their testimony? Listen to the words of the uncalled witness, Dr. Harold C. Urey.
Detailed data on the atomic bomb would require 80 to 90 volumes of close print, which only a scientist or engineer would be able to read. Any spies capable of picking up this information will get information more rapidly by staying at home and working in their own laboratories.
Listen to what the science editor of Time magazine said.
Some of Greenglass's testimony made little scientific sense.
And Life magazine.
Greenglass's implosion bomb appears illogical, if not downright unworkable.
So much for the scientist, Greenglass. But now let's hear from top atomic scientists who tell us how secret the atom bomb really is. Again, Dr. Urey.
There is no secret of the atom bomb that could be kept.
In 1949, when Russia exploded its first atomic bomb, Dr. Wendell Latimer, University of California chemistry professor and wartime plutonium researcher, said,
"Now that we are rid of the illusion that we are the only ones who can make a bomb, we can devote our energy to progress instead of giving all our time to protecting false secrets."
In 1950, the Atomic Energy Commission bared secret documentary proof that Russia had known the scientific secret of atom bomb manufacture since 1940, 5 years before Greenglass claimed to have made his sketches. Now the date is 1951. The speaker, Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer, another uncalled witness.
There are no unpublished secrets concerning atomic weapons, and no secret laws of nature available to only a few.
But the prosecution relentlessly built its case. Here is the damning evidence. A console table which had belonged to the Rosenbergs, but which the government had impounded. Ruth Greenglass is now on the stand. The prosecuting attorney is questioning.
Now, Mrs. Greenglass, on any of your visits to the Rosenberg apartment, did you notice any particular piece of furniture?
Yes, a mahogany console table.
Did you have any conversation with the Rosenbergs concerning that table?
Yes, I admired the table and I asked Ethel when she bought it. She said she'd gotten it as a gift, and Julia said it was from a friend, and it was a special kind of table. And he turned the table on its side to show us why it was so special.
What did he show you when he turned the table on its side?
There was a portion of the table that was hollowed out for a lamp, so that the table could be used for photographic purposes.
And did Julius Rosenberg tell you what he photographed?
Yes. He said he took pictures on microfilm of typewritten notes.
This is the testimony of the second star witness for the prosecution. But where was the console table to support her testimony? The impounded table was never produced in the courtroom. Why not? Was the prosecution afraid of the testimony of a table? This is the record. The case against the Rosenbergs depended almost entirely on the testimony of Ruth and David Greenglass. And the weaker the case, the more fantastic the charges.
My brother-in-law spent $50 to $75 a night on entertaining.
Julius Rosenberg subsidized the education of likely espionage agents.
My brother-in-law was given unlimited funds by the Russians to recruit spies in defense plants and government agencies.
He received a citation from the Russian for his work.
But no sums of money were found in the Rosenberg home or deposited in banks. No members of the alleged spy ring were produced in court. No citation, no students, no prospective spies, no one to back up David and Ruth Greenglass's testimony. As for the written evidence, of 32 documents produced in the court, not one connected the Rosenbergs with any espionage plot. No, it wasn't the evidence that made the case against the Rosenbergs. It was the poison of our time. The poison of paid confessions and conformity, of atom bombs and witch hunts. After only 15 days of trial, the government and defense attorneys rested their cases. The verdict was brought in. Guilty as charged. And then Judge Kaufman passed a sentence unprecedented in the annals of American justice. In justification of this sentence, the judge made a fantastic charge.
Your crime is worse than murder. I believe your conduct in putting the A-bomb into the hands of the Russians years before our best scientists predicted Russia would perfect the bomb has already caused the communist aggression in Korea, with the resultant casualties exceeding 50,000 Americans. And who knows but what millions more of innocent people may pay the price of your betrayal. Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, for the crime for which you have been convicted, you are hereby sentenced to the punishment of death.
Death to the Rosenbergs. Death in peacetime. Not for treason. Not for espionage. But for an unproved charge of conspiracy to commit espionage. The world stood shocked. Death in peacetime for a crime which could not exist. As Ethel Rosenberg was led from the courtroom, she faced the press. Her voice was low but steady.
We said, and we say again, that we are victims of the grossest type of political frame-up ever known in America.
And so, for 18 months, she waited in Sing Sing's death row while her case was being appealed. 18 horror-ridden months of screams she dared not utter, of a hope she dared not hold too firmly. A few weeks after she was brought to Sing Sing, Ethel wrote her attorney.
When you see the warden next, won't you plead with him to allow me to have Michael's plant outside my cell where I can just see it, but not touch it? At the very least, couldn't I see it just once so that I can truthfully tell Michael what it looks like? Do you really think it won't occur to Mike that my silence about it is due to the fact that I was not permitted to receive it? My God. What harm can there possibly be? What crime committed if I'm allowed this one token of love from my darling children, whom I have not seen for close to a year now? Beg him to let me have it, won't you?
And Mike and Robbie? It was 18 months before the children saw their parents again. They drove down to Sing Sing with the Rosenbergs' attorney, Emmanuel Block, and his wife. Mrs. Block tells of the trip.
After the shock of the arrest, we wondered how the children would take the visit with their parents. Because of the long separation, we had decided that it would be best for the children to visit with each parent separately. As we drew up to the prison gates, there was only the sound of the gravel beneath the wheels, and inside the car, only silence. I watched Mike's grown-up, 9-year-old face tighten. The twitch he had developed in the past year was more noticeable. I felt the blood pounding in my chest as my husband and the boys left the car and disappeared inside the prison. Only the lawyer was allowed to see the prisoners. And I waited those 2 endless hours in the car, wondering, praying that the visit would come out all right.
After the children saw their father, the attorney left them in the receiving room. Mike wore a baseball cap. The guard, sitting on the edge of the table, swinging his leg, smiled at him.
You're quite a baseball fan, ain't you, kid? What does your father think about it?
Oh, he keeps up with all the scores. I send him the scores when I write him.
Too bad it's going to be over so soon.
When the baseball season's over, then it's football.
Pretty smart, ain't you, kid? I'll remember that one. Say, would you like me to show you the place?
Well, maybe after I see my mother.
Sure. If there's time, I'll show you. You'd like to see the electric chair, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you?
I don't want to see anything. I don't want to see anything.
Ah, you cry, baby. Stop that crying, kid. There's nothing to it. Say, did you ever see a gun like this? Here, look here, kid. I'm an FBI agent.
My father's not going to die. He's not going to die.
Stop it, man. Are you crazy? What are you doing to the children? Did you hear him?
I certainly did, and I'm reporting you, Mr. Garvey.
Ah, it's only having a little fun with him. Didn't do no harm.
Get out of here. I'm sorry this had to happen, Mr. Block. Come on, Mike. Don't pay any attention to that man. He doesn't know any better.
Take it easy, Mike. You're not going to let this spoil your visit with your mother, are you?
I'm all right.
Now I'll leave you alone. Your mother's coming.
What should I talk about, Manny?
Oh, there's lots to talk about, Mike. School, Grandma Sophie, your piano lessons.
Michael. Robbie. Hey, you squealed too hard. My, how you've grown so. Why, I'd never have known you from your picture. And Robbie. Robbie? Manny, doesn't he know me anymore?
He was only 3, Ethel. Give him a little time. He'll warm up.
Of course. Mike, tell me how you're getting along with Grandma Rosenberg.
Okay, I guess. Only the kids don't play with us anymore. I'm afraid their parents will spank them. So I just come home after school and practice piano. Robbie, he doesn't do anything but look out the window at the cars. Hardly anybody comes to see us, except Manny and his wife, and sometimes that maid. I play piano for him. Did you like the plant I sent you? The one of the blue flowers?
Oh, it was beautiful, Mike. Tell me, what do you play on the piano?
Next year I'm going to play great.
Gee,
I wish you could play for us like you used to.
I don't have a piano here, but I still sing. Do you remember any of the songs we used to sing?
Well,
go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody, go tell Aunt Rhody.
Look, Ethel, Robbie remembers too. He's coming to you.
Mommy!
18 months. Of silence from the press, silence from the radio, silence everywhere but in the heart. 18 months, and committees sprang up all over the country. Pamphlets were written, meetings held. 50,000 people signed an amicus brief urging that a new trial be held. Letters poured in from all over the world. England, China, the Netherlands, Japan, France. France. A France that remembered another case in another time. The Dreyfus affair. Like Julius Rosenberg, Dreyfus was a young Jew of 35, an officer in the French army, falsely accused of turning over military secrets to another country. And for this he was condemned to life imprisonment. But then, as now, people of courage demanded that the case be reopened and the facts brought to light. Emile Zola was one of these. And for his burning indictment of that frame-up, Zola himself was brought to trial. In 1890, Zola faced a jury.
The Dreyfus case. Oh, gentlemen, that has now become a very small affair. There is no longer a Dreyfus case. The question now is whether France is still the France of the rights of man. The France that gave freedom to the world and that ought to give it justice. Are we still the most noble, the most fraternal, the most generous nation? Shall we preserve our reputation in Europe for equity and humanity? Are not all the victories that we have won called in question? Open your eyes and understand that to be in such confusion, the French soul must have been stirred to its depths in the face of a terrible danger. A nation cannot be thus upset without imperiling its moral existence. This is an exceptionally serious hour. The safety of the nation is at stake.
Yes, the safety of a great nation is at stake. Are we still the America of democracy, of justice, of freedom? Are not our recent victories called in question by this case? If the Rosenbergs die, shall we preserve our reputation in the world for equity and humanity? Shall a Dreyfus have rotted in prison if we have learned nothing from history? Where is justice? In the rehearsed accusations of a terrified Greenglass? Or in the facts? Facts that never came to light in Judge Kaufman's court. Shall the Rosenbergs die while we live in doubt? The American people have a right to demand that the Rosenberg case be reopened in the full light of day. Listen now to the words of Ethel Rosenberg.
We do not want to die. We are young and yearn for a long life of accomplishment. Yet, if the only alternative to death is the purchase of life at the cost of personal dignity and abandonment of the struggle for democracy and ethical standards, there is no future for us, or any legacy we can leave our children, or those who survive and follow us. For the sake of American democracy, justice, and brotherhood, for the sake of peace and bread and roses, and the innocent laughter of little children, we shall remain here in dignity and pride, and in the deep abiding knowledge of our innocence before God and man.
Are those the words of a traitor? Upon each of you here in this room rests the responsibility of life for two people who have already accepted the responsibility of your lives. Pick up a sheet of paper, pen and ink. Write to President Truman now, this very hour. The Rosenbergs have but days to live. Wire him tonight. Demand clemency. The Rosenbergs must live.